Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
If the Hanoi Hilton could not break John McCain's resolve to do what is best for his country, you can be sure the angry left never will.
President Bush, with his biggest applause line from the video screen speech at the Republican convention last night that he did from the White House. The speakers went hard at Barack Obama, as Fred Thompson did here as well.
To deal with these challenges, the Democrats present a history-making nominee for president. History-making in that he's the most liberal, most inexperienced nominee to ever run for president.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC from the Republican convention in St. Paul. We'll play a very different kind of Fred Thompson clip in a minute, something that had people in the hall in tears, literally. With me now, Stephen Dinan, Washington Times correspondent covering the convention here, and Ben Smith covering the campaign for Politico.com. He's got a piece on Politico today with documents detailing more of Sarah Palin's political life. Ben, welcome back. Stephen, welcome to WNYC today.
Good to be here.
Ben, where are you? Are you in town here in St. Paul?
Yeah, I'm in St. Paul.
All right. Stephen Dinan actually came down to our 2 square feet at Radio Row, and it's a good thing that you didn't, Ben, because we really have got no place to put you. Stephen, what got into Fred Thompson last night? He ran such a sleepy campaign, but he really gave a rousing speech.
You actually heard delegates outside or in the hall afterwards saying if only he'd done that during the campaign, we would have been maybe looking at a different guy on Thursday night here. You heard all sorts of jokes, too. I heard one guy joking that, well, he'd had 4 months of rest, so he was rested and recovered and ready to give this sort of speech. He's shown the ability to do these sort of speeches in the past, but for whatever reason, he just never got going in the campaign. He had a very specific role here. One of the things that we discovered in the campaign, he's not very good at talking about himself, but he's a pretty good spokesman for other people. And he last night, that was essentially his role, was to sell both John McCain's war record, in particular his time in a North Vietnamese prisoner of war camp, and then to take the shots at Obama, that, you know, half of that tag team duty with Lieberman. And given both those charges, he did exactly what the McCain campaign wanted him to do.
I think so. And Ben, before we leave that Bush clip behind, I don't know if you've been hearing from any Democrats after that. Did anybody call you saying, hey, the president was red-baiting there, saying if the Hanoi Hilton couldn't hold John McCain, then the angry left certainly will not? That sounded like something out of 1969.
Yeah, I mean, it was red meat, if not red baiting. I mean, it certainly wasn't, you know, the harshest thing we're going to hear at this convention.
Right. I want to play a bit of a longer clip from Fred Thompson, as I said we would do. And I know that everybody knows McCain was a POW, but Stephen, you mentioned this was one of his roles, Thompson, last night, to do the bio on McCain. And I thought having Thompson stretch out and tell the story was one of the most effective things last night. And no matter what you think of John McCain, no matter who you're going to vote for in this election, his story is compelling. Here he is running for president of the United States, and I think it's worth dwelling on for a couple of minutes.
That's definitely what the McCain campaign knows that. And one of the interesting things will be how much more of this we get through the rest of this week. Thompson essentially laid the groundwork. I assume we'll see continued references to that. One of the weird things was that the hall was incredibly quiet during that. The old pin drop cliche, but it was true. At times, it actually looked like Thompson had even lost the audience in the middle of this story, but as you noted earlier, there were literally people with tears in their eyes. And at some of these, you know, when he talking about him not being able to raise his arm anymore to be able to salute the flag, that's the sort of stuff where McCain sort of has this this presumption of patriotism. That's the sort of thing, the image that strikes home with people, that he couldn't even do that.
So that's not the precise clip that I pulled here. Yep. About not being able to raise the arms, but here is a bit of that John McCain POW story. And listen here for the moving emotion in the story itself and the moving detail and how Thompson frames it politically at the beginning and the end of this clip.
John McCain knows about hope. That's all he had. For propaganda purposes, his captors offered to let him go home. John McCain refused. He refused to leave ahead of men who had been there longer. He refused to abandon his conscience and his honor, even for his freedom. He refused, even though his captors warned him, "It will be very bad for you." They were right. It was. The guards cracked ribs, broke teeth off at their gums. They cinched a rope around his arms and painfully drew back his shoulders. Over 4 days, every 2 or 3 hours, the beatings resumed. During one especially fierce beating, he fell again, breaking his arm. John was beaten for communicating with other prisoners. He was beaten for not communicating with so-called peace delegations. He was beaten for not giving information during interrogations. When his captors wanted to know the names of the other pilots in the squadron, John gave them the name of the offensive line of the Green Bay Packers. Whenever John was returned to his cell, walking if he could, dragged if he couldn't, as he passed his other fellow POWs, he would often call out to them. He'd smile, give them a thumbs up. For 5.5 years, this went on. John McCain's bones may have been broken, but his spirit never was. Now, being a POW doesn't qualify anyone to be president, but it does reveal character.
Being a POW doesn't qualify anyone to be president, but it does reveal character. And that bit of politics, along with the reference of hope, reference to hope politically at the beginning of the clip, the political wrapping, but the very, very moving story of John McCain that probably many Americans still don't know that many details about. And Stephen Dunnan from the Washington Times, the old major network, you were here, so you didn't see. I was watching television flipping around. The old major networks were already in coverage at that time, all three of them, but they all had talking heads, blah, 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 while people were literally crying in the hall at that moment. But the cable channels all carried it.
It's one of the weirdest things about the way that these conventions are covered now is exactly, I saw, I guess it was Dave Barry had a column last week from Denver where he noted that what you see is talking heads talking to each other with their backs to what's going on the stage, and that's the way that Americans are seeing these conventions now. And they missed, those who are watching the networks at that time would have missed a lot of those details about McCain's life. One of the interesting things about that is that McCain oftentimes, he shared a number of these stories from his time there. He shared the story about Mike Christian, the guy who had the flag sewn into his shirt. He shared the story about the prison guard who drew a cross on Christmas Day 1 year, drew a cross in the sand and then rubbed it out. But Thompson had stories that folks haven't necessarily heard about McCain. And as you said, there were tears in people's eyes. It was a fairly powerful. It was a good delivery. It was a very good delivery.
And listeners, we can take phone calls with your reactions to any of the speeches last night at 212-433-WNYC, or your comments or questions about the record of Sarah Palin, which our other guest Ben Smith from Politico.com has been looking into, and we'll turn to that now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. We will get back to some more speech clips, one of Joe Lieberman actually going after Barack Obama, and a clip actually from NBC's coverage last night, part of an interview with Laura Bush, where she used some interesting language with respect to Sarah Palin. But Ben Smith, your piece on Politico.com today is about documents put together by Tony Knowles, her Democratic opponent in the 2006 gubernatorial race. So what, you got your hands on some oppo research?
Yeah, I mean, this is often kind of an overhyped term. I mean, basically, it was a. What it showed, I mean, it showed both you know, her weaknesses as a candidate being, you know, that she had had a fraction of the experience 2 years ago of Knowles, who had been a former governor of Alaska, and they were talking about how she wasn't ready for prime time, how she wasn't ready to be governor of Alaska. That was the attempt to campaign against her, which failed. But also, you know, her charm, like all of her, all of the sort of indiscretions and elements of a criminal record they turned up were incredibly ordinary. You know, she had been caught fishing with a drift gill net without a permit at one point. Things like that. Nothing that was going to shock anybody in Alaska.
Hey, that's a neighborhood buster in Alaska. Come on, no drift net.
No permit.
So was that the drift net permit? Was that the thrust of your story then, that they weren't able to come up with much on her, that her record is very clean?
Well, no, it's just, I wouldn't say it's necessarily clean. It's really interesting and nuanced and detailed. And she certainly, it's not the record of Evan Bayh, you know. It's not one of these guys who's been running for office all his life. She started, actually looked like she was planning to, or thinking about leaving politics a couple years ago. She started a company called Rouge Coup, which is French for redneck, which was meant to be a marketing company of some kind.
Anything in this 63-page document with respect to her policy positions or managerial style?
Lots on her managerial style. She had lots of conflict with subordinates in her time as Wasilla Mayor. She kind of came in and had been thought of as a fairly, nonpartisan position. The City Hall there is the size of a New York subway station. The sort of above ground, like 72nd Street station. And she had run a quite ideological race and then came in and had a lot of conflict with some of the kind of department heads, the police chief there, things like that.
And that's the thrust, Stephen Dinan, of the story on the front of the New York Times today, which is about her record and which talks about how, you know, here was the sleepy town of Wasilla, Alaska, population about 5,000. The kinds of local politics there had been, who do you like better, Joe or Jane? And Sarah Palin came in the mid-90s, that was the height of the Newt Gingrich era in Washington, with an ideological campaign. So her flyers were about no legal abortion. Her flyers were about gun rights, things like this, which was very unusual then for the kind of race that she was running, which is mayor of Wasilla, where those things may not have been the most relevant issues to mayor. But so she came in as a new, almost national politics, Republican, ideological candidate. Have you been looking into this at all yourself?
Not so much that side of things, but there's no question she's a crusader and has a number of crusades. As you talked about, there, some of the social issues crusades. She also lays claim to having gone head-to-head with a lot of the political forces in her own party and just the political forces in Alaska. And that's what you got is somebody who the McCain campaign is sticking out there as the perfect complement to him on that matter.
All right, we have a call to take, and it is Kim in Ridgewood. Kim, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me on. I'm just getting really super frustrated with, and not you guys, because you give a lot of great information, but unfortunately, I don't think that the broader public, the United States, is hearing. We're letting the Republican Party frame this conversation about Sarah Palin. She's this big reformer, and she's like a maverick like he is and stuff, and I think she's definitely business as usual in Alaskan politics. I mean, she came in and first thing she did in this tiny little town that she was mayor of was get a lobbyist, one who worked for Ted Stevens, by the way, or is affiliated with him in some way, and we all know how corrupt he is, and started getting all this money from the federal government for this tiny little town. So she's supposedly really against earmarks, and yet she got like $27 million for this town of who knows how many, 5,000, 6,000 people.
Right. It was about 5,400 when she was mayor. Now it's about 9,000, I understand.
Okay. So, yeah, at that time, and she came in and she said thanks but no thanks to the Bridge to Nowhere, which was not the case at all. She was totally for it. So we're letting them, frame this as though this woman is this maverick, this reformer and everything, and it's a crock.
OK, Kim. Thanks for your call. We talked yesterday some on the show about the details of the bridge to nowhere position that she took, where really she was for it before she was against it. She was happy to take the federal money until the cost of the project skyrocketed. The federal funds did not keep up with that, so the cost to the state would have been more than originally would have, and that's when she decided to come out opposed to it. So it wasn't really the way it was framed necessarily, like this principal position against taking any earmarks. And Ben, I wonder if the document that you saw or any of the other reporting that you did indicated her position on earmarks in general as mayor. That Bridge to Nowhere story had to do with her time as governor, but as mayor, I've heard this too, the lobby firm associated with Ted Stevens. Of course, he was indicted only recently. She was mayor back then. But regardless, as most politicians would, it seems like she actually went after as much federal money as she could possibly get and got $27 million for this small town.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she was the mayor of this. I mean, it's hard to blame her. She was the mayor of a town, and, you know, it would have been malpractice for her to not try to get federal money for it. Alaska is, for various reasons, kind of awash in government money of various kinds, and she certainly, you know, tried to get it for her town. But I don't. I mean, certainly, when the 2006 race, when they were coming up with opposition research on it, nobody saw it on her. Nobody saw it as a negative that she'd kind of brought home the bacon for her town.
Anything you want to add to that, Stephen? Are the Republicans, Stephen Dinan from the Washington Times, are the Republicans now being put on the defensive here in St. Paul? Because at least that, which is, you know, is not these personal stories that are coming floating around, but this is the policy, this is the character issue that they're trying to really sell with respect to Sarah Palin. Maybe she wasn't this anti-earmark crusader. Maybe she was more of a politics-as-usual mayor who, as a mayor might be expected to do, went after as much federal money as she could get for her city.
Yeah, very much so. I would take some exception with the caller. I'm not usually one to defend my profession, but in this case, I think it's safe to say that the press has been flooded with these sorts of stories looking into. I mean, she was a blank slate when we heard about her less than a week ago. You know, on Friday, McCain announced her. She was a blank slate, and I think it's safe to say that the press has done a pretty good job of digging up a lot of stuff here and raising a number of questions. The McCain campaign says a lot of the questions are just unfair and out of bounds and just not true, that it's rumor-mongering. But essentially what you're going to get is her speech here is going to be, folks have described it as the make-or-break event of this convention. She's a blank slate. She's going to have a chance to explain exactly how she wants to be seen, and she's going to define herself tonight. And the question is how good a job she does of that. If she defines herself in the minds of the voters as a reformer, then that's going to make it tougher for all the attacks to come back at her from here on out.
Let's take another call. Bob in Manhattan. Bob, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You
know, a lot of these attacks that are coming against Governor Palin, specifically about her daughter and about her her daughter being pregnant, are coming from people that, you know, from the left, that this is supposed to be their cause that they're triumphing. They're sounding like a bunch of hypocrites.
It certainly puts people on the other side of this discussion than they usually find themselves. And there's a Laura Bush clip that I want to play from NBC News last night that actually goes right to this in a minute. So, Bob, thank you for your call. Why don't we just go to Laura Bush. Laura Bush was being interviewed by Tom Brokaw and Brian Williams on NBC about Sarah Palin. Listen to this. This is about a minute.
You said on Fox News yesterday, the other side, meaning the Democrats, will have to be particularly careful. What were you talking about? What did you mean?
Well, the question that was asked was, did I think there would be sexism? And I wonder if we aren't already seeing a little bit of it. But I think it's, you know, when a woman runs, there women are held to some different standard, I think, than men. No one would be talking about a man's children and how many children they had or any other thing about their children. So I think it's really important that we treat Sarah Palin the same way.
I want to ask you about that. Do you see any examples of it? Is it the other side is also coming after her on the merits, countering the executive experience point by pointing out she was the mayor of a very, very small town and Alaska's relative population?
And I think that really sounds a little bit elitist to act like, because it's a small, you could say Alaska's the largest largest state in the nation, which of course it is geographically. But she's very experienced. Not only is she experienced, she's got really great judgment. And I think that's what's really important.
So we heard sexism, we heard elitism, and Stephen Dynan. You know, that's really pretty interesting. And I think if, you know, as the caller Bob points out, imagine if it was Hillary Clinton who just recently had a child with Down syndrome, and she was running for president or vice president, and the media start asking, well, who's going to take care of your baby? I think Democrats might be a little bit upset about that.
I think that's probably true. There are a couple of interesting things out of that clip. One of them is that Laura Bush has been a very interesting presence here this week. She, in the middle of the hurricane stuff, when you had the Republicans saying they were going to cut down on the politicking, she was out doing quite a bit of very subtle politicking with some attacks on Democrats, subtle. But so she's been an interesting figure where she's been able to keep politics going even when they said they were down. And that clip is an example of how she's gotten pretty good at this game. And the other aspect, of course, is you have a very clear sort of pitch for Hillary voters involved in there. It's, you know, as she mentioned, the sexism issue. There, after Hillary lost her bid, you heard all these folks coming out. There are women who supported Hillary who came out and said part of the reason why they weren't going to vote for Obama is because they did not like the sexism in the Democratic Party. So Laura Bush, it's a pretty calculated comment, and we'll see how successful. But she knows her role here.
She
at this
is
convention.
Playing a very interesting role here, and interesting that even the fact that she is here in person when her husband, the president, is not.
You know, there's another interesting thing about that. If you look at the last two presidents who were in Bush's situation, Reagan, who served out two terms, and then Clinton, who served out two terms and came to the convention at the end of there, both of them had opening night, primetime, you know, keynote speech. They weren't actually the convention keynote, but had the prime speaking slot for the opening night of the convention. Here they give President Bush a nine-minute, I mean, he'd planned to be in person, but it was always a short sort of speech. They basically got him out of the way as quickly as possible. It's really an interesting way of looking at it. Part of that's just because, part of the issue there is that he doesn't have his own vice president running to be his successor, where the other two did in Gore and Bush. But the changeover last night from getting the president out of the way to moving on to these two friends of McCain in Thompson and Lieberman, it was really stark.
And Ben Smith, the other part of what Laura Bush said in that clip, maybe you can't make an argument that Alaska should be seen as the largest state because it's the largest state in area. That was a little weird. But the Eastern elitism, right? Politically, it's a very interesting dynamic in terms of how it may play out in this election, and maybe something that a lot of people in the press are missing. Because whether it's elitism, you know, or not, there's Eastern, if you consider Chicago the East. I mean, it's really the Midwest. But you have an Illinois-Delaware ticket with the Democrats. You have an Arizona-Alaska ticket with the Republicans. And there may be a kind of regional pride that's being put into play here. The fact that, I mean, we all know people from relatively small towns who are tough cookies. And people from places, Ben, like we're from, New York, can very easily look down our noses at people from small places, whether they're in upstate New York or whether they're in upstate Alaska, and say, oh, they're just rubes, they don't know anything. But that's going to energize people against that kind of position. That's what Laura Bush was getting at by talking about this elitism, I think, looking down at her because she was mayor only of a small town, she was governor only of Alaska. There may be an energizing political dynamic in there in the left half of the country.
Yeah, certainly the West, I mean, parts of the West are very much in play, particularly New Mexico and Colorado. I don't think that, you know, we necessarily have to let them get away with this. I mean, what happened here is that she had a terrible rollout, total disaster, and they are scraping around for a way to court to sort of create a backlash to the terrible press she's been getting. The sexism thing is particularly kind of astonishing. This is a party that has deplored identity politics for decades, has mocked other Democrats' allegations of sexism for, you know, as long as we can remember. Sarah Palin last year, sort of, or earlier this year, you know, said that she thought it was too bad that Hillary Clinton was perceived to be whining about her unfair treatment and that did all women a disservice, even if the treatment was unfair. And, you know, she has a bad couple days, and it's in the talking point from the First Lady on down is that it's horrible media sexism. I mean, for instance, I haven't, and maybe I'm missing this story, like I haven't written any stories about people saying that she should stay home with her kids. I saw one CNN host say that, which was a dumb thing to say and was then widely circulated by the Republicans. But, I mean, yeah. Maybe I'm missing
well, it,
but
it was
I think she's protesting a little too much.
Maybe it was just a dumb story in the New York Times yesterday about the new mommy wars over Sarah Palin's personal decisions here and whether to go back to work. But I don't know. Stephen Dinan from the Washington Times, are you hearing it at all among social conservative delegates here at the convention? Because these would be the kinds of people who in their personal lives might be more critical of the professional moms in their neighborhoods who leave their kids with daycare or whatever, who they would criticize as being careerist and selfish rather than staying home with their children as traditional values might indicate.
You're not hearing it here among the delegates here. I'm certain that that strand is out there somewhere in the country, but you're not hearing it here. Her selection, and Ben's exactly right, she's had a bad few days. One of the interesting things about that, though, is the rallying around her. Maybe it's not so surprising, but the rallying around her that's gone on here by those delegates. The enthusiasm for McCain's campaign before her announcement was sort of among the folks here. Her announcement completely changed that. I can't tell you how many of the social conservative, the evangelical and fiscal conservative leaders I've heard who can't, I mean, their eyes start rolling around in their head and the smiles just get huge on their face. Like, she's wonderful. It's amazing what she's done for the energy of this group here in backing McCain.
And my gut, just politically, is that this has been a big plus for the McCain candidacy, despite all the questions about Palin in the media. And who knows where it's going to go. A week from now, she may have to pull out because things are coming out that, you know, nobody knew about her. The press is just starting to dig into her. But my sense of the delegates is that they're so much more enthusiastic now than they would have been without her. You saw that too. And it's a Karl Rove strategy. It takes McCain off his centrist message and puts him back into the bringing out the base approach to winning the election. There is a question of whether he can have it both ways.
Well, here's the problem with that strategy. The first 5 or 6 months of the election, the McCain, or I guess since February, so the McCain folks had said very specifically, they don't think, thanks to President Bush, they don't think there are enough Republicans out there. They can't run a base strategy because the Republican brand name is damaged so much. They can't win this election based on only turning out the Republicans the way that Rove and Rove did for Bush in 2004. So we'll have to see. I mean, her selection certainly has galvanized those Republicans, but if the McCain camp's read was right originally, that there aren't enough Republicans out there, it may actually backfire on them if she can't actually grab some of those middle voters or the Hillary voters.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the Republican convention with Stephen Dinan from the Washington Times, who is here, Ben Smith from Politico.com, who's also here in St. Paul. And before we run out of time, I want to play one clip from Joe Lieberman's speech last night. He was the major speaker, really, who the country really got to see. Maybe you heard in that Laura Bush clip as she was being interviewed by Brian Williams, you could hear Fred Thompson giving his speech in the background. That speech that we played clips before that was actually so effective in the hall, but much of America was not seeing it as the old line networks like NBC were doing other things like interviewing Laura Bush. Joe Lieberman was the major speaker who the country did get to see in the 10 o'clock Eastern time hour. And, of course, he has that unique position of being a former Democrat and Al Gore's running mate in 2000. Listen to how hard he was willing to go after the Democratic nominee, Barack Obama.
In the Senate, during the 3.5 years that Senator Obama has been a member, he has not reached across party lines to accomplish anything significant, nor has he been willing to take on powerful interest groups in the Democratic Party to get something done. And I just ask you to contrast that with John McCain's record of independence and bipartisanship. But let me go one further. And this may make history here at this Republican convention. Let me contrast Barack Obama's record to the record of the last Democratic president, Bill Clinton, who stood up to some of those same Democratic interest groups, worked with Republicans, and got some important things done, like welfare reform, free trade agreements, and a balanced budget.
Thank you.
Now, I'm honored to say just a word about the great lady that John McCain has selected as his running mate.
All right, and there he goes on to praise Sarah Palin, which in itself was a little bit surprising to some people. Here he's talking about Sarah Palin's experience, but Barack Obama doesn't have experience. Stephen Dinan, what do you want to say about that?
Notice what he had. He had the Republican convention applauding Bill Clinton in that clip. It's amazing. He had, by this comparison, he had the Republicans applauding Bill Clinton and welfare reform accomplishments, having worked with the Republican Congress at the time. It's such a weird thing. The Democrats are furious. The Obama campaign this morning accused him of flat-out lying, of Lieberman of flat-out lying and saying that that Obama had never crossed party lines to work with Democrats.
And in fairness to Obama, Bill Adair from PolitiFact, the fact-checking service of Congressional Quarterly, who was a guest here yesterday, gave that Lieberman line a false rating today on his website, naming several ways in which Obama himself has worked across the aisle, including on bipartisan ethics reform and on foreign policy with Richard Lugar, two of the examples that he gave. So according to the nonpartisan PolitiFact, Joe Lieberman did go too far last night. But we're going to leave it there with Stephen Dinan from The Washington Times, Ben Smith from Politico.com. Thanks a lot for coming on with us.
Thank you.
And coming up next, here in St. Paul, the former governor of New Jersey, Christy Whitman. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC at the Republican Convention in St. Paul. With me now, the former governor of New Jersey, also former EPA administrator, Christine Todd Whitman. These days, she's doing a number of things. She runs the Whitman Strategy Group, which helps companies still make money while becoming more green. She's co-chair of the Republican Leadership Council with former Senator John Danforth. And she is chair of the Clean and Safe Energy Coalition, which I believe is a pro-nuclear power group. Is that
yes.
right, Governor?
Yeah.
So this is an interesting time for nuclear power. Did you notice that in Senator Obama's acceptance
yes.
speech,
oh, yes. I saw
he
that.
Promised to work for safe ways to produce more nuclear
right,
energy?
Right.
What did you make of that?
Well, I was pleased by that. What CASE is trying to do is get the information out to people so they can make an informed decision. The fact that nuclear is 20% of our power today, that in fact it's the only form of base power that produces no regulated air pollutants while producing power, and then let them make the decision of how are we going to meet our energy needs. And so to hear him say that, because it's been hard for Democrats, particularly because of Harry Reid and the repository issue, is very encouraging. John McCain has talked about nuclear. It's encouraging because, frankly, we have got to meet some serious energy demands that are coming at us pretty fast, and there's no silver bullet. Nuclear isn't the answer, but it is part of the answer, and people need to understand that.
And so when Obama talks about finding ways to make safe nuclear energy, do you think that puts him in any different position, ultimately, than John McCain? Does it mean that he's going to hold out for something that's not yet there at contemporary nuclear power plants?
Not as far as the safety is concerned. If you read some of his other his statements on, and this is a problem for every Democrat with Harry Reid leading the Senate, is the repository issue, which is a major one. What are you doing with the spent rods? They're held safely on site now, but that's not optimum. And the federal government requires a national repository. That's in Nevada. Harry Reid's in Nevada. He said no way, no how. So if Senator Obama says we can do everything, but I won't go forward until we have a national repository, that's going to be a real problem. What you have John McCain saying is we need to deal with this issue. We need to also look at recycling and reprocessing, which is being done now in France and in Japan and being done very successfully, which vastly reduces the amount of spent material that has to be housed anywhere. And you can render it, that's what they're working on now, rendering it so it in no way could be used for nuclear weapons. It wouldn't be weapon grade. And we're very far along. I'd hate to see, and that's the only thing we don't 100% know yet with Senator Obama, whether he'd say, can't go forward without that national repository. That shouldn't be the backbreaker.
why is a national repository the way to go? You know, there are some environmentalists who say, yes, in my backyard. And what they mean by that is every neighborhood, depending on the kind of pollution we're talking about, mm-hmm. or area of the country with respect to nuclear power, should have to house the waste that they produce, that's what's going to lead to the most responsible energy production.
Well, clearly with nuclear, you're not talking about something that is benign or can be handled lightly. And it takes a high standard. It takes the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to set those standards. And it becomes very expensive if you were to require every place to have the kind of facility that Yucca Mountain, let's say, would be and is designed to be. As I say, right now they're being housed safely, either in holding ponds at the facilities or in above-ground bunkers that are highly reinforced. But to have so many, there are 104 nuclear plants around the country, to have 104 different sites that have to be policed by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, that have to meet these standards, I think people would feel more confident, and that's what the federal government did when they passed the law that said you have to have a national repository, and that is part of it. And maybe they go back and say, no, there can be two or three places rather than one place. But I think people feel better rather than having 104 different places if they were down to two or three.
Am I right politically that I've heard that this issue is putting Nevada into play this year, usually a Republican state, but could conceivably go for Obama partly because of their opposition to having that national repository there?
They are absolutely dedicated to not having that repository there, and it's a huge issue for them, and that's why you have even Senator Ensign, the Republican, who is against that for that reason. It's political suicide in Nevada to say that you want to have, that you'd go for Yucca Mountain, and that's one of the things that's appealing about John McCain. He understands the politics behind this, but he also looks at the bigger issue and says, for the country, we've got to solve this problem, and if this is where we've put so much money and the design has gone in and it's deemed safe, then we ought to move forward.
Christy Whitman, former New Jersey governor, former EPA administrator, my guest for just another few minutes here on WNYC at the Republican convention on another issue. You are a Republican moderate, as the term usually goes, with respect to choice on abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Are you distressed at the selection of Governor Palin to be John McCain's running mate?
Well, not distressed in the sense that John McCain has been a strong pro-life person all his life, and I've understood that, so it's not that a great surprise from that perspective. Do I agree with her on it? No, I don't, obviously. I am someone who is pro-choice, not pro-abortion, but pro-choice, and I will continue to be that way. But I look at the other issues that are so important facing this country, the economy, the war, the energy issues, and I look at who is going to best address those issues, looking at the two teams, and we're going to find out more about Sarah Palin as time goes on, and certainly tomorrow night will be an important speech for her.
The Anchorage Daily News was reporting yesterday that she is so anti-abortion rights that she answered a question in the 2006 gubernatorial race in Alaska. If her daughter got pregnant through rape, what would she do? And Governor Palin said, choose life.
Well, that, I, you know, obviously I would say very, very strongly that would be her daughter's decision.
Do you feel at all that her experience, well, I'm going to read you from a letter in the Washington Post yesterday that mentions you. And it says, I am sure that Sarah Palin is a fine woman and a good governor, but Alaska is a state that would go Republican no matter what. He could have picked any number of tested, intelligent Republicans such as Condoleezza Rice, Christine Todd Whitman, or others. I prefer to see candidates who will provide some leadership and some judgment. I want them to be able to run the country. It's a nice compliment to you.
Well, thank you very much, but it was never going to happen. You know, this is something that I think the American people will have to judge over this next few months. We've got the time. There's a lot that goes into leadership, more than just a certain time in a particular office. It goes to judgment. It goes to understanding. It goes to the experiences that you've had, and they're multiple. We've seen too often that women's experience is denigrated somehow when men have about the same level of experience. Women don't get credit for it, so I think we're going to have to take a look, and that's what people will be deciding for themselves.
Last question, a New Jersey question. I think you're the last Republican to be elected statewide.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In New Jersey. Why is the state, why is the entire Northeast at this point trending so much more Democratic than it used to?
Well, it's always been a very moderate part of the country. And certainly from the perspective of the Republicans, if you look at the image that's been projected out of Washington, the Hill, everything, it has projected a party that's narrow-minded, mean-spirited, and litmus test. And that's just not where the majority of the American people are, and certainly in the Northeast they're not that way. We are so diverse in our cultural background, our ethnic makeup, religious, and everything else, that we tend to say that there's never only just one right way to do things and one person who has all the answers, and that's been difficult.
But if John McCain was the one who was going to break out of that box, does the selection of a running mate from the religious right put him back in it, put the party back in it?
I don't think it puts him back in it. He has all demonstrated his ability to separate himself from what the mainstream of the party or the far right of the party would want. I mean, this is a political, obviously, episode that we're in, and John McCain was looked on by the far right as being very problematic because he wasn't in lockstep with him. Is he pro-life? Yes. But did he believe in stem cell research? Yes. Did he think Abu Ghraib was a problem? Yes. So he has shown his ability to separate himself, and that's what people will judge.
What do you think the odds are that he could win New Jersey?
Oh, I always put New Jersey as a toss-up. I never know what it's going to do.
Governor Kristi Whitman, thank you very much.
A pleasure.
WNYC, as we continue our Meet the Delegate series here at the Republican Convention in St. Paul. With me is a delegate from North Carolina named Justin Burr. He's a bail bondsman just elected to the North Carolina State Legislature. Thanks for joining us. Tell us where you're from exactly and what's great about your hometown.
All right. I am from Stanley County, Albemarle, North Carolina, about 45 minutes east of Charlotte. We are a small community of about 60,000, and we've got the Yawarra National Forest, a lot of lakes around us, and just a great small town home atmosphere that we all love.
What made you want to get into politics from there?
Well, I have been interested in politics since I was a young child. Don't have anyone in my family that's interested or involved. I've gotten them involved since then, but since I was a young child, it's something I've always had a passion about, and I just got involved, started as a teenage Republican, and probably when I was 12 or 13, and kept going, got elected to as a precinct chairman, went on, became a county chairman of the Republican Party, and then elected this year to the North Carolina State Legislature, to the State House.
How old are you now?
I just turned 23.
Will you be the youngest member of the legislature?
I will be. I will be the youngest. My understanding right now is I'm the youngest Republican ever elected in the history of the state to a statewide office.
So what gave you this passion for politics? Were there formative issues early on? Did you have any life experiences or what?
I grew up watching President Reagan on television, and I believe he inspired me and really wanted to get involved from that. And I mean, you're talking about I was a young child then. And just ever since then, it's something that I have had a passion about and have spent, you know, through high school, middle school, even younger than that, that I've followed and been involved with.
So as you enter elected office, what's your dream in terms of what you would want to accomplish for the people in your district or the people of the country, however broadly you want to look at it?
Well, for me, you know, my big issue is representing the folks that I've been elected that have elected me, and my constituents, my neighbors, are what I'm going to Raleigh to serve, and they're my community. And you know, I have, as you run for these positions, and a lot of these guys that are there, you know, they spend a lot of time meeting with the lobbyists and talking with the lobbyists and all these other bad things that are involved in our government that, you know, really bring us down, I believe. And you know, I've stood firm, you know, letting all these groups that want to meet with you and endorse you. I've met with them, but when they ask about meeting with their lobbyists and other things, I tell them I'm not interested, you know, that I believe we need to take government in a different direction. And I went to Raleigh to represent my neighbors, not the lobbyists that work in Raleigh. So.
But to get what done, precisely?
Local issues. We've got highway construction that's behind by 10 or 15 years in my community. We've got some judicial issues. Our judicial districts are split up by different counties, and we need to look at that again. And different issues like that, along with our taxes. Every year, no matter what's going on, the General Assembly typically raises the state budget by about $1 billion. Doesn't matter what they need or what they don't need. They just up at $1 billion. So we've seen it go up $1 billion every year for nearly the last 10 years. And, you know, that's something that I want to work with to stop that for the taxpayers.
What does it mean to you to be a Republican in 2008?
Oh, I'm excited. I think especially after last week when Senator McCain nominated Sarah Palin, I believe that was a boost for the Republican Party. And I have seen people that have kind of pulled out of politics in the last 3 or 4 years and gotten worn out. They have been enthused in the last 4 or 5 days over this. And before I came here on Sunday or Saturday, I was trying to pack and couldn't get packed till probably 12 o'clock that night. I had so many people calling all day long that are just wanting to get back involved in politics.
Because of her beliefs? Because people say it couldn't be about her experience?
Well, I think so. I think she is the right choice. You know, she fits in line with the John McCain, the Maverick, and I believe she is a conservative. And she represents the conservative movement and the Republican Party that we all believe in and where we should be. You know, she's taken on the corruption in Alaska, and she defeated a Republican incumbent who was had some issues there. And, you know, she's dealt with the oil issue in Alaska. And, the issues that we really need to focus on, she knows this year.
Who did you originally support in the primaries?
I was 100% behind Mike Huckabee, and he was my candidate. I had a great opportunity to spend a little bit of time with him back in 2002 when he went campaigning for some candidates I was working for down in Alabama, and ever since have just loved him to death, and I think he is a wonderful man, kind of your average down-to-earth guy.
Now, he was the last man standing against John McCain, so can you get enthusiastic about this candidate if you were for Mike Huckabee?
Oh, yeah, I think so, because you look at the two of them, and they're very similar. You know, they both were courteous to each other during the primary. They didn't attack each other. And I can get behind John McCain 150%. There's no doubt about that.
Justin Burr, Boy Wonder, delegate from North Carolina. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you, sir, very much.
And we'll check back in now with Pilar Marrero from WNYC's Feed in Two Worlds Immigration Series in conjunction with the Center for New York City Affairs at the New School. Pilar is a reporter and columnist with La Opinion, the nation's leading Spanish language newspaper. She talked with us last week at the Democratic Convention, and now she's back with us for the goings-on here in St. Paul. Hey, Pilar, what's the percentage or the presence of Latinos here as delegates compared to Denver?
I haven't been able to find a specific number. They refused to give it. I heard from somebody it was around 1%, but I don't know for sure. I do know the California delegation, which is the largest delegation, is 12% minority, and that includes blacks, Asians, Hispanics, and gays. This is what they told me. So, you know, taking that into account, you know, in the state that, you know, over 60% of people are so-called minorities, 12% is not really representative of that.
Right. Well, Latinos voted about 2-1 Democratic nationwide in the 2006 elections. Does that bring down along certain lines within the many Latino communities? Who are those Republican Latinos?
Well, the Republican Latinos are usually the Chamber of Commerce type entrepreneurs, people who have escalated a little bit more on the economic ladder. People who have a strong military background are attracted to John McCain, for example, and who are very religious and conservative. You know, many of them evangelical.
Same as in any other population.
Right.
We're coming up against the news here, but the Wall Street Journal reported today that the Sarah Palin pick has exposed rifts among women. Do you think that this social conservatism would attract a lot of Latinas in a largely pro-life Catholic population?
Well, not if they look at the platform. I mean, the platform that the party passed on Monday had several anti-immigrant parts of it, and that has a lot of leaders really upset about the Republican Party and its positions right now.
So you think immigration is the most salient issue for people's voting decisions?
Well, not the most salient, but it is something that pulls, that really gets to the heart of Latinos. And they might be thinking about the economy and health and other issues that are more important, education. But, they feel, and this has been confirmed in the polls, they don't approve of, and most Latinos don't approve of this kind of English-only positions.
Pilar Marrero from La Opinión and WNYC's Feet into Worlds program in conjunction with the New School. Thanks a lot.